what are the powers and functions of the ombud, and this all is linked to Section 8 of the Act, which deals specifically or provides specifically for the independence and impartiality, which states that the ombud and the staff members must serve independently and impartially and must perform their functions in good faith and without fear, favour, bias or prejudice subject to the Constitution and the law. From that, we can go from the stance that when anybody associated with the office of the ombud performs the functions required by the Act and required for the purpose of dealing with anything that comes to that office, and people should not be interfering. It's a functional thing. So we drew a distinction between the functional independence and the financial issues, the reporting and when what must go to the minister and what the minister's role is in relation to the ombud. So for that, we then look to the fact that the Act says the minister must assist to protect the independence of the ombud. So that is something that is an obligation. The minister must do, and the department then by association must do all that it can to assist, to provide a situation, an atmosphere wherein this ombud can function. And in then the Act even takes a general, broader than the department and the minister, saying no person may interfere or cause hindrance to the work of the ombud. So that the department then must cooperate with the access to facilities, information and documents in the performance of the ombud's duties. Then also just looking at the way in independence-wise and how it functions, what the Act also entrenches the independence of the ombud, providing that the president appoints, not the minister appoints, the president appoints, and then if required also removes. The Act empowers the ombud to appoint staff in terms of that. So whoever heads the ombud gets to appoint the staff to that office. Then when it comes to the determination of remuneration and other terms of service, that's done not only by the minister, but the minister along, so in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. It's not something that is done but individually. It's not a decision that somebody takes arbitrarily. There is consultation on that. So for that purpose, there needs to be some sort of a reporting line when money, when there is a budget item, a line item, that spends money for certain purposes like remuneration and the managing of an office from one point to another. Pardon. So that gets done through the minister's office, the department. So everything the minister does with that must be consistent with the Act. Anything the minister in any way that is acted, in any way the department and the staff act must be consistent with that, to avoid functional interference. And to test independence when it comes to legislation, we look at sufficient security of tenure, financial security and protection from any possible arbitrary interference. And in our office's opinion, that is set in the Act. The fact that the president is there, the fact that the term is clear, non-renewable, financial security in that it's done with the Minister of Finance, it's not just the Minister of Defense that deals with that, and that the Act prevents anybody from or says that no one may interfere with the exercise, nobody may hinder that. Then also just looking at the case law with that in mind, our courts have said that there is nothing wrong with accounting to the executive on a financial and budgetary matter. Just accounting the way you have spent something to ensure that you can function does not imply that somebody is interfering with your actual functioning and performance of your powers and duties. So in that sense, the object of independence, as far as we see it in the Act, is effectively secured with the required institutional independence that the ombud needs to function. If in any case there is an issue where somebody feels that there is interference or that appropriate access to information or resources is not given for the office of the ombud to function, that is more an application issue. It's more almost an administrative issue than it is a legislative one. We always draw a distinction between what the law provides and requires and how somebody individually applies that. people are flawed, we make mistakes, but we can't say that the law in regard to the independence of the Ombudsman is not sufficient. For that, the interpretation for us is clear. If at any event there is a question where anybody involved in the execution of this act feels that something is not being applied to properly on the ground, the Advisory Committee has the sufficient oversight power, if anybody comes with a problem, for that to be determined on the oversight that Parliament has over the executive. Through you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lutz, for the presentation. Colleagues, we will then ask the entity to, are there any questions of clarity before I ask the entity to take us through the outcomes of the study into the same issue? All right. So the entity in the cities needs to be a public entity.
Thank you, Chair. With regard to the Public Finance Management Act, I can just highlight here with regard to the issues. The Act in Section 10 says the Ombudsman must be subject to the Public Finance Management Act. And then if we look at the Public Finance Management Act, we come to the entity specifically. So the Ombudsman Act, it draws in the standards, the financial standards required when we're dealing in the public sector and with public funds. But when it comes to Schedule 3 entities, Section 47 of the Public Finance Management Act says that the accounting authority for a public entity that is not listed in either the Schedule 2 or 3 must notify the National Treasury in writing that the public entity is not listed if that is so required. As far as we can determine, that has not happened. So there is the option to notify the National Treasury and ask for that to happen. But as far as we can see, the principles and standards of the Public Finance Management Act has been drawn into the Ombudsman Act, but nothing has been done for it to be listed as a public entity for that purpose.
But that does not detract from the fact that it is. That it is not listed does not mean that it is not.
It functions within the same realm and requirements, Chair.
So in which case, the accounting authority, if it has a board, the accounting officer authority will be the board. If it does not have the board, then the accounting officer will be the CEO of the entity.
Chairperson, the Ombuds is responsible in that type of hierarchy for everything that happens within. So the Ombuds is the head for that purpose, accounts to this functioning. But because it's not a schedule fee listed entity, the head in practice, while it is accounting for the functionality and how it functions, must report to Parliament from a budget perspective through the Minister. So when it comes to finances, it's the Minister that ultimately must report to Parliament and Treasury on what has happened. That's why we regard the section in the Act that requires a report to the Minister, not as interfering with the functioning. For functioning purposes, the head of that office is the Ombuds. But for reporting on budgetary purposes, because it is not completely separate in terms of National Treasury standards and PSMA standards, because it has not asked to be a listed entity. It's a bit of a overlap, but we don't regard the functional independence where the Ombud is the head as being undermined by the fact that the Minister is reporting to Parliament on information provided by the Ombud as the head.
I was just asking the accounting authority in terms of the PFMA. I can see the reporting lines. In terms of the Ombud, the accounting authority of the accounting office of the department will be the HOD. All right, but of the public entity, if there's a board, it will be the board. If does not have a board, it will be its CEO. But in this case, because it's led by the Ombuds, it will be the Ombuds. I just want to get the clarity on that.
Chair, can I just say this? to assist in this, because there is a particular context in which this development happened. And you are asking very pertinent questions, which I'm sure are the questions that are bothering the Military Homeward Office team, because the status of the office is not as clear as it should be. PFMA says for you to be an entity, you must be declared as such. The Military Ombud, although it exists as an organ of state, it does not have the status of being a Schedule 3 entity as required by PFMA. So I think that's where the issues are coming up. And Chair, maybe I should take you into confidence that these are the issues that were discussed at the time that the bill was being promoted through the parliamentary process. And I think the parliamentary legal services at the time advocated for the creation of an office of the Chief Executive Officer for the Military Ombud. But the committee at the time and the institution, in their wisdom, decided not to go that route. And I think these are the issues that are being debated even to this day, whether we have given the office the status that it requires for it to be able to do the work. So I don't think Dr. Woods and I can be able to give you any definitive answers to the question you're asking, but we can reflect on what the Act provides for now. There are policy issues that have to be debated by members and this committee on what direction we should be taking as a country in as far as the Office of the Military Ombud is. But at the moment, the Act seems to provide sufficient safeguards for them operationally to be independent. But there are issues of institutional arrangement that could be, which you and I will not be privy to, but I'm sure the members of the office will be able to share those. That may be undermining the independence of the office. But those are not necessarily legislative issues, but are issues of how the two institutions, that is the Ministry of Defense or the Department of Defense, relates to the Office of the Military Ombud. But we will leave that part to the office to deal with if there are those issues that need to be dealt with. And the committee has the authority to exercise oversight over the department if the department in any way undermines the independence of the office through institutional arrangements. But as the legal services, parliamentary legal services will be limited to that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think this the presentation, especially the presentation, these two, I think provides sufficient background for us to then be able to invite the presentation from the entity itself. At least you can see where the questions are. And your presentation, I don't know, it should just zoom in into the issues of independence. I know that the inquiry, the study you commissioned was not limited to this person. It was broader than it. But for the sake of this meeting, we would appreciate it if you could just zoom in into the issues of independence, as it were. Thanks. General, over to you. The new ombuds.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members.
Sorry, you may excuse. You may be excused. Thanks.
I've had many interactions with this committee as the Chief of Staff of the Department. That's what I'm coming this time in my capacity as the newly appointed military ombud. I'm leading a delegation made up of my deputy advocate Simpiwe Damani, the director executive support, Mrs. Lindy Mazulu, The chief director operations advocate Yuki Dube, and Mr. Mpo Mahalimela, chief corporate staff. Chair and honorable members, the presentation that we have prepared from my office was a presentation on the follow-up discussion of the discussion that was held with the committee previously. And in essence, what it does is to capture the actions that have been taken by the office since the last time the office interacted with the committee. And of course, it will come out that, for instance, there were representations to the minister requesting to issue a directive that would assist in trying to resolve some of the operational and functional obstacles that the office was encountering. Of course, when we were preparing this presentation, we didn't have the benefit of the legal opinion that the committee sought. That has now been shared with us. And I think after the presentation itself, maybe we'll also have time to engage on the legal opinion itself. The presentation will be made by Advocate Dube, after which then we will be open to the discussion, Chair.
Thank you so much, General. Advocate Dube.
Sorry, Chair, I omitted just to tender an apology for the Deputy Minister of Defense, who was supposed to be here.
Thanks. Thank you. We'll record that as such.
Thank you, General, and thank you, Chairperson. So the presentation that we will be providing today will be divided into this section. Firstly, we will reflect on the purpose of why we are here. We'll, of course, look at the legislative mandate of the Office of the Minister of Ombudsman. We have also indicated what our vision and mission is, because it does touch on the issue of independence. We then, of course, zoom into the question of independence as it relates to the current legislative provision. We thought also we should provide what we have established are the characteristics of an ombud office in general as it relates to independence, so that we are able to determine whether or not our office is in line with that. And then over the years, in fact, since establishment, the office has really grappled with the institutional form as of the ombud. And quite a lot of work has happened, and a number of key milestones have been achieved. So we will take you through just a chronological breakdown of the work that the office has done since establishment, in order to answer this question of independence, particularly the status of the office. So the purpose, really, Chair, is to take you through the work that the Military Ombud has done to really determine what is the correct institutional form of the Office of the Military Ombud as it relates to independence. Now, the legislation in terms of the mandate of the office is empowers the ombud to investigate complaints of members or former members of the public, if they are complaining against the conduct of a member of the defense force. As well as, of course, any person that is acting on behalf of a member can approach the office to lodge complaints. So that is the mandate of the Office of the Military Ombud. What is important after the office has finalized the investigations is that the ombud is then required to provide a report with recommendations of what will be the appropriate relief to the minister for implementation.
Sorry. Colleagues, I can see the print is too small, and I have difficulty reading it from where I am, but that doesn't pose a problem, advocate, because we do have the hard copies. What do you prefer, colleagues? Do you prefer following it through this? Because if you do, then we can then set the lights on, so as not to put you in more strain. And we can continue using the slides, but we'll follow the presentation on the hard copies. Is that one, colleagues? Thank you so much.
So the onward, once we've completed the investigation, we will then issue the report with recommendations to the minister in the event that the complaint is upheld. So what is our vision as an institution is that we want to be a leading independent and impartial military ombud institution. Our vision is also to provide an independent and impartial expeditious complaints resolution process. So you can see the emphasis on independence and impartiality in the vision and the mission of the office. Now, when we get to the question of independence, what are the legislative provisions in the Military Ombud Act 4 of 2012 as it currently stands? Firstly, if you look at the preamble of the Act, it provides for the establishment of an independent office of military ombuds. So the first thing you see when you look at the Act, it says establishment of an independent office of the military ombud. And then Section 6, Subsection 4, then enjoins us when we conduct the investigation that not only must we be fair and expeditious, but we must conduct those without fear, favor, or prejudice. The Act prescribes also that the ombud and staff members must serve independently and impartially when we are performing the function of the ombud. And of course that we must perform those in good faith and without fear, favor, bias, or prejudice. The minister is also required to assist the ombud to protect the independence and impartiality and dignity of the office. I think it's a point that in the legal opinion is emphasized quite strongly. So that's what the legislation provides. Also, persons are prevented from obstructing the ombud in performing, or the members in performing their duties in terms of the Act. So these provisions talk to the functional independence of the military ombud. So it's very clear that in the current legislation, the ombud is empowered to conduct the investigations without fear or favor, and they also must not be obstructed. Jefferson, just an apology to the members. There are a few typos here on slide number 7, so which we apologize. But the section 1, of course, establishes the office as a separate office. Section 8 then empowers the ombud to appoint his own human resources, determine the remuneration, and so on. So from a human resource perspective, the ombud has the power to appoint the staff, as well as determine the necessary policies that relate to regulating human resource. And then the Act under Section 10, Subsection 1, is that the funds from of the office must be appropriated by Parliament as part of the budget vote of the Department of Defence. And then Section 10, Subsection 2, requires the military ombud to account for all those monies that you would have saved, and how, you know, the office has utilized its budget. So the responsibility for accounting on the budget allocated to the military ombud in terms of section 10 subsection 2 lies with the military ombud. Section 11 then relates to reporting annually on the activities that the office has performed during the financial year. So the ombud is required to submit a report to the minister for the purposes of filing to parliament our annual activities. These, of course, these provisions really talk to the financial reporting responsibilities of the military ombud. Now, what we have identified as challenges, and it's been an issue of discussion over the years, I think, as we've heard from the legal team, is while the Act establishes the Office of the Military Ombud as an independent office, it has not expressly defined it as a public entity or a Schedule 3. The office has done a benchmark with other similar institutions, and they have looked at what the legal provisions are in relation to their establishment. For an example, the pension fund adjudicator, the community scheme ombud service. So typically, you will get a provision in the Act in those entities that says the community scheme ombud service or the National Consumer Commission is hereby established as a juristic person, and commissioner, for example, the National Consumer Commission is the accounting authority. So the Act will be very clear. It will not stop as to the National Consumer Commission is hereby established. It then goes further to say it's established as a juristic person, and also explain who the executive and the accounting authority would be. So our Act only establishes the office, and that has been identified as the challenge. And section 10, subsection 1, as well as subsection 2, relates to the allocation of budget and the accounting and reporting on that budget. So when you read that, you would expect that the military ombud, therefore, is the accounting officer, so should be accounting as per the PFMA requirements. But because the budget is located within the Department of Defense, and as we know, the SECDEF is the accounting officer. So it's not a challenge of the legislation per se. It could really be how those provisions are operationalized, because ultimately the accounting, the office, is not done by the military ombud, but is done by the SECDEF. The office also identified how the members and the complainants perceive the office when it comes to independence. That until the question of the status of the office is clarified, there is the risk of losing credibility amongst those members to say you are meant to be independent in terms of the legislation. However, of course, you operate almost as if a unit within, you know, defense. There could be those questions about, you know, credibility. It's an issue that our outreach has reported whenever they go out and meet members and conduct education campaigns. However, it still remains anecdotal evidence for now. So what the office has done is that we probably need to conduct a public perception survey so that we really understand, is it really a genuine issue, or could it be just one member, you know, during an outreach raising their question and say, but are you really independent? And so the office is embarking on a public perception survey so that at least we've got report that will then, you know, talk to the issue of credibility and perception of independence amongst the members. So Jefferson, we then looked at generally what has been reported as a characteristics of an ombudsman in relation to independence. We thought it is important just to reflect on this you know, point, so that we can see to what extent is our office aligned to it. I'll just you know, pick a few. That an ombudsman is expected to be independent and non-partisan. Of course, you'll be provided all the powers in the Constitution or the relevant legislation, and he's, of course, supposed to operate impartially and independent. So if you look at what is seen as a general those characteristics of an ombudsman office vis-a-vis the legislation, I think those are in tandem. The only issue of note is other ombuds have got the powers to conduct what we refer to as own initiative or to self, you know, initiate investigations. But that, of course, we don't have that in our legislation, so we have to receive complaints, which will then trigger the investigation. So over the years, there's been quite a lot of action that has been taken, and we thought it's important to reflect to the committee chronologically to get to where we are today. Can I just highlight these highlights instead of going through, you know, the stuff? I think the key highlights of, you know, the, some of the key milestones is that the office has not only presented before the Council on Defense, it is engaged with the National Treasury, the Auditor General, and that then triggered the advice for the Ministry on Board to seek technical advice from GTEC, which is the government technical advisory unit of the National Treasury. So GTEC started with the study. The request was for them to conduct a status quo analysis as well as the advice on what would be the best institutional model to give effect to the provisions of independence for the military ombuds. So the report from GTEC was received by the office in May this year of 2019. And in summary, the GTEC, after it has done quite a thorough situational analysis, looked at what could be the most viable option to ensure and guarantee institutional independence of the military ombud. One, they said, there of course is the Schedule 3 option. However, they cautioned against going through that option because it involves a lot of cost. It would mean that the office, the budget, could even double the current budget that we have, and they also indicated the current reluctance within, you know, government to have the increase in the number of public entities. So, so that would have been an ideal institutional form for the office, but the current environment could be such that it is not viable for the office to become a Schedule 3. So they would then look at, there is an option though to still ensure that the military ombud operates independently. Functional independence is guaranteed, the act is sufficient. But when it comes to operational independence, issues of, you know, how the ombud manages HR, finance, IT, all of that. So they refer to that as an enhanced autonomy, to say Already the minister has delegated in terms of the ministerial directive to the ombuds, giving directives for the ombuds to be able to manage his resources, human resource, finance, IT and so on. But perhaps what really is needed is the operationalization of those ministerial directives, and that is, you know, what is referred to as enhanced autonomy. So this is where we are, Chair, in relation to the issue. So what are our key prioritizations? The first is, of course, to, as an institution, to finalize the implementation plan of those ministerial directives. So officials within the military ombud are working with officials in the DOD to then operationalize those ministerial directives. So an implementation plan would need to be developed. I mentioned also the need to conduct a public perception survey to really assess whether or not is the question of perception of lack of independence, is it true? And we would hope that this study will assist us to have the answer. We have also identified some legislative amendments that will provide for institutional forms. As we said, the ideal form has been identified to be a Schedule 3. It could be that, you know, in the long term objective of, you know, the office, if we do need to amend the legislation, make it clear and, you know, state that you are a juristic person, the ombud is an accounting officer. But also, Chair, around the legislative amendments, there's an issue that has always been addressing us to say, are the recommendations of the Ministry Ombud binding? Because, you know, the SPS Ombud must recommend to the Minister for implementation. What happens when they are not implemented? What, you know,
the law says there are recommendations.
Yes.
The question is, what happens if they are ignored?
Yes.
Chairperson,
in a nutshell, that presentation, those are the three, you know, priorities for the office for now. Thank you.
Right. No, thanks. Over to you, General Masonde, to conclude.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. That's the presentation from our side. And I think in terms of the key priorities, you would understand that we from the office, there's still a pursuit for to provide for them the institutional independence. Although, of course, we view that as a long-term thing, given the current challenges and constraints in terms of our economy. Because even the study that was commissioned of GTEC, actually made those two recommendations and indicated that they are not mutually exclusive, you know. One is the issue of enhanced operational or functional, you know, autonomy, and secondly is to pursue the route of establishing the office as a Schedule 3A institution. So we are now open for discussion, Chair, on the basis of those positions. Yes.
Before I throw it open, let me look at you, Advocate Njikela. What was the rationale behind this act, and whether the reason for establishing this act are fully met by the entity that exists. In other words, there was a reason, a good reason, why we needed this act. Our colleagues, I'm sure, in their minds, they would start to think what could have been the reason for coming up with this act, you know. But that is one thing. And now examining whether the the operations, you know, we now have the Act, whether the implementation of the Act, all right, because we're implementing the Act, gives full effect to the resolutions, you know, to the rationale, to the reasons for coming up with the Act. It's a matter that we need to look at, you know, because if it doesn't, okay, and then it will question why government must spend the money it is spending on the body if it is just an extension of the department, you know. It's embedded, as it were. It's embedded. You know, if you are embedded, it means that your ability to act with sufficient independence, it's weak. It's weakened. All right? And if it is weakened, then it will then lead to the perception that you're talking about, you know, where people say, but we thought with the creation of this body, these were our expectations, but we don't see our expectations being met. All right, maybe let's look at the rationale and then move back and then check whether in the implementation we are able to fully, you know, account for it.
Chair, I am in a way in a very difficult position for reasons of history which I can explain to you later. but I think all of the issues that have been raised in the presentation are the issues that the portfolio committee engaged on when it considered the bill at the time. And that's why earlier on I said these are policy issues which the committee must consider. Policy changes from time to time. If it is a consideration today that we need to strengthen the independence of the Office of the Military Ombud, it's a decision that is within the discretion of this committee. And of course with consultation with the Minister of Defence on where we're going. If you look at the history of the bill, you can see the different versions of what today is the Military Ombud Act, because there were different versions where all of us were making suggestions on how the office must be strengthened. The Parliamentary Legal Services, I can remember quite clearly, made the proposal that the colleagues are making now, that the office must be strengthened. The discussion took place, and the committee at the time made a decision that we don't want, this is not a Chapter 9 institution, and therefore it may not require the level of independence that other Chapter 9 institutions are entitled to. But it was a policy decision. So I think it is for the committee to consider what has been presented. There is a good cause for the committee to apply itself to what has just been said. As to whether in practice the lack of clarity with regard to the status of that office, if it impacts on its independence and operations. And I think the advocate has touched on certain issues with regard to financial independence. That's one hallmark of independence. At the moment, the financially, the Secretary for Defense is the accounting officer, not the military ombud. That is an issue that the committee needs to consider, whether that undermines the independence of the office. Institutionally, the Office of the Military Ombud relies on the Department of Defense. The committee needs to consider what is the impact of that on the operations of the military ombud. But most importantly, Chair, which I think is something that maybe should be emphasized, is the perception of independence. Because independence is not whether you are independent or not. It's whether me as an ordinary soldier, when I look at you and how you are related to the department, whether I can trust you to deal with my issue independently. And these are the things that I think perception of independence is very important. But again, Chair, the committee has to consider this thing and make a decision on how it proceeds. If the committee at any stage of its consideration comes to a conclusion that there needs to be a change, there are three ways to proceed. One is an executive bill, which must come from the Minister of Defense, proposing the changes that the advocate was alluding to. Secondly, there could be a committee bill, which is initiated by the committee itself. Thirdly, there could be a private member's bill, which could be initiated by any member of parliament to give effect to the proposals that are being put forward. So I think, Chair, in as much as I have this information, but at the end of the day, I'm going to throw it back to the committee because you have to consider these things and see how you can help the Office of the Military Ombudsman to go forward.
All right, no, thank you so much, colleagues. The matter is now on the table for discussion. Any comments? Because my next question, General Mason, was whether the body, we now understand the limitations. Budget, and that if you want to make it a fully fledged entity, it means you can't do it with the staff that you, the staff complement you currently have. It might actually double your staff, and that will have budgetary implications. That money we do not have. And understanding that, we know the situation of the accounts. But the question is whether you are able to achieve what you were meant to achieve. Because we are able to achieve what you are meant to achieve. Probably that will be we would say at least we can make do with what we have, because it doesn't undermine the purpose for which it was established. The problem is when it undermines the purpose for which it was established. But I don't think, like we are saying, you are still able to, you know, do act without fear or favor and deliver on the mandate without, you know, rocking the boat as it were. All right. So that's the situation, colleagues, we have. And any other comment?
Colleagues?
Silence on the other hand is confusion.
Yes, Mr. Murray.
Chair, the only comment that one request is for the ombud. We have now a new ombud, and that is just to make sure that we make this ombud work. And if there are any stumbling blocks as we go along, that the ombud must report back to us where we can assist them. But, I mean, there's no purpose having an ombud, and there's constantly complaints that nothing happens of the complaints that goes to the ombud. So the ombud, I think, is for us very important. And we would, you know, be privileged to support the ombud. But then there must be actions. You know, actions speak louder than words, or that is especially on paper. So please, that is, I think, what all that we do. We know that we need an ombud. We have had the act. We must just make sure that we stay within those parameters, or amend when it is deemed necessary. Thank you.
All right, colleagues. Any other? Right. Doesn't look like there's any other thing we can add to this, yes, General. Just before I recognize you, except to say that we would want to see the ministerial directives given effect to, because I'm told the intention is to enhance the institutional autonomy, independence, sorry, the institutional independence of the body. At least on that one, we I'm sure as a committee, we can monitor, because that at least takes us away from a situation where even the trust into the body may actually be affected. General Masson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I do understand that the committee in seeking legal opinion didn't specifically also look into the issue of whether the recommendations are binding or not. And I would urge assistance in terms of that issue. Although the current situation is that not many of the recommendations have not been implemented, many have been actually accepted, and those that have not been implemented, I think even the office itself realized that there was some kind of an overreach on their part,
on the part of
the office itself, I think when they were reviewing those. But I'm just thinking of a case where the office strongly feels that this position is right and the minister does not accept this recommendation. You know, then the complainants will actually lose faith in the institution itself in terms of you know, its independence and its ability to prosecute its work in a fair and impartial manner.
All right. Perhaps I note that it's been raised before. Last time we asked you to give us the analysis of the age analysis of the outstanding cases that you investigated, the nature of the cases. And the decision and the reasons possibly given why they could not be they remain outstanding. Right. We need that information. We thought that information would assist us in evaluating how serious are the decisions of the body being taken by the powers that be, by the departmental officials, the management. Maybe that general, it will be on case by case basis. And so we'll leave it at that. Maybe in the future, our intention will be just to look at progress you are making. We'll not wait for us to deal with these things at the end of the year. If we could have it quarterly reports, that will help us in monitoring that the intentions of the bill, of the act, are actually given effect to. With that, colleagues, our time, with that, we can then close any other the meeting. But before I close the meeting, I think I can release you, General, and I can also release you, General and the team, and I can also release you, Advocate. It's remains for me just to thank you for your guidance, and thank you, General, for the interaction. Just 1 minute, colleagues, after the team has left, but we can discuss it. We are circulating the revised program for the term. The revised program for the term today is the 13th, and we only have this item. And on the 20th, that's next week, we there is a defense amendment bill that went through Parliament to the NSOP, and the report is that it was passed with the amendment. And this amendment now.